This episode of the Miriam Institute podcast was recorded on March 25th, 2020, during the coronavirus pandemic. And due to the shelter-in-place orders, it features a telephonic interview of Pinchas Landau, an Israeli economist and financial analyst, conducted by Alan Marks, board member at the Miriam Institute. The interview was entitled The Economic Ramifications and Opportunities in the Wake of the COVID-19 Pandemic. During the course of the conversation, the two explore that very topic, and as they did so, they successfully highlighted the areas particular to the State of Israel and those areas and aspects of the economic implications that demonstrate just how universal the challenge at hand is, showing how accurate it is to say that Israel is, in many senses, a microcosm of the broader challenges spanning the globe at the time of this recording. I hope you enjoy this episode of the podcast, a product of the Miriam Institute. Israel's future in Israel's hands.
Welcome, everybody. This is Alan Marks. Shalom. Pleasure today to be talking with Pinchas Landau about the impact of the coronavirus crisis on Israel and the Israeli economy. Israel comes into this with a relatively strong, healthy economy, one of the strongest in the world, low unemployment, high GDP growth, and like everywhere else, things have suddenly changed. Pinchas, what's been the effect of the corona crisis so far on Israel and its economy?
Okay, first, hi everyone. Good morning, I guess, to most people in the US, and good early evening from Israel, from Jerusalem. To answer your question, the impact has been stunning. The economy is facing. Let me start by saying that everything is unprecedented. You know, this is the most overworked word in the language, but we are in a situation where it's literally true, and certainly nowhere more so than in economic activity. So the impact of the crisis, which is unfolding and which is ratcheting up because the government is steadily increasing the degree of limitations on movement on the citizenry as a whole, and the definitions of who can go to work and where and how. So the impact is rolling forward with increasingly basically devastating results. Any attempt to whitewash what's happening would be wrong. And I'm sure we're going to talk about this as we move forward, but I want you right at the beginning to kind of get into your heads a distinction between the domestic economy and what the economists call the external sector, which is trade in goods and services, and everything that goes under that headline. And so when I talk about the impact, it has been primarily noticeable in the domestic economy. And although the very first sector to be hit was tourism, which is technically overseas because it's both incoming tourists from around the world plus Israelis going abroad, but we've gone far beyond that, and the focus is increasingly on what is happening in the domestic economy, both in the retail sector, which is obviously badly hit, and in production, and so on and so on.
Well, Pinchas, let me ask a question on that, because services make up almost 70% of the Israeli economy, and certainly some sectors, you mentioned tourism and retail, are dramatically adversely impacted in the near term. What about other technology or pharmaceuticals or other sectors, many of which may be either export-driven or tied into multinational corporations? How's the effect different?
Okay, let's try and break this down. When you say high-tech, so everybody immediately thinks of Startup Nation, startup companies, and everything that goes with that kind of concept. And it would seem to be, and everything is, again, to stress, everything is developing in real time. The impact on the high-tech sector in its classic sense of people working in on computers in offices, developing and then software and that kind of thing. The impact has been considerably less than on old economy production oriented companies. Many, I think, that the vast majority of high tech companies, those that can, in to a greater or lesser degree, have sent their people home and they are working from home. This is very, very widespread. Doubtless, their productivity is reduced by working from home. Those of them who have children, obviously so. But nevertheless, they are able to carry on to a significant degree, and therefore those companies are still functioning. I just read a piece a short time ago to the effect that many of these companies are still hiring, albeit much less volume than was the case a few weeks ago. So the point that we can make here is that the cutting-edge high-tech sector, and especially the R&D, the research and development centers of foreign companies, stretching from, you know, everybody, Intel, Google, all the big players who are here with significant R&D centers, are functioning in a kind of dispersed, decentralized manner, and so the hit to them is much reduced.
Let me focus on employment as well, because the labor side of this is probably the one which presents the most challenges day-to-day to people on the street. Israel, as recently as a month ago, had an unemployment rate of 3.35%. And I know Israel tracks employment numbers rather better than many other countries do. How is that already changing?
Okay, so here we come to this terrible divide, which is a key feature of the Israeli economy, between the high-tech sector in which for the purposes of our discussion, high-tech is reckoned to employ around 9 or 10% of the total workforce. And as I've just said, they have been less badly hit. The general economy, particularly the domestic economy, which again for our purposes includes tourism, which in its widest sense of all the ancillary areas around tourism is a very large employer of low income people, they have been massacred, right? They have been gutted. And you mentioned the fact that unemployment is being tracked, right? So classically, unemployment is measured by a survey and it's published once a month, and everybody is happy with that. Israel has a very effective system of registering for unemployment, which is now being considerably expanded. The bottom line is that the employment service, the government employment service, can measure by the hour how many people are applying for unemployment. And this was running literally at thousands of requests per hour. The pace has gone down somewhat, but we are talking of around 500,000 people now. In American terms, it's small beer. The total workforce is maybe 4 million people. We are talking today of conservatively 15% unemployment, and it's only March the 24th, right? So this is the scale and the speed at which things are changing and in clearly in that direction. And much of the discussion in the policy area as well is, what is the government doing? What can it do? What should it do to help these people who are either dismissed outright, or more typically what companies have been doing is putting people on unpaid leave.
Is the government also doing, providing assistance somehow to the parts of the population which do not participate ordinarily in the labor force? Obviously there's a low unemployment rate pre-coronavirus, but labor participation is, let's say Israel has different issues maybe than some other countries do.
Absolutely, and right.
Many communities are being especially hard hit by the virus.
Right. So now we come to a much broader issue of what is the government doing and how is it doing it and so on, and what measures are being taken, and there's a big gulf, as you will soon discover in America, between announcing and even legislating on the one hand versus actually implementing and getting the money to the people. So Israel has announced many things and has put into place many programs for unemployed people, for self-employed people. There has not been any significant program for the kind of people you're talking about, people who are not in the labor force. And this brings us, inevitably, this brings us to the perhaps the largest problem of all, which is that there is no government, and more specifically, there is no budget. The way an administration, an executive branch addresses these issues is by having a budget or making a new budget, whatever it is you need to do. And that is, of course, a legislative procedure, which requires planning and so on and so on. All of these things bring us to the great black hole. There is no government. There is no budget for 2020. They were using the extended 2019 budget, which is obviously completely unsuitable. The Treasury and other ministries are using very constructive, shall we say, means of moving money around from one ministry to another, from one use to another within the existing budgets. But this is all tinkering. And there's a desperate need for the mechanism for the, of government to work, which means, first and foremost, a budget, which means having a government, which means having a functioning parliament, and so on.
So in the absence of a government, while Israel is dealing with, you know, constitutional or political challenges apart from the coronavirus, how much flexibility does the Bank of Israel and Treasury officials, how much flexibility do they have to deal with both fiscal and monetary issues in the absence of Knesset direction, in the absence of a Knesset, frankly?
Yes, absolutely. So, 2 days ago, the Knesset finally managed to form a Knesset Finance Committee, which is incredibly important, both as an oversight mechanism and as a mechanism for shifting, for authorizing the shifting of money around. So that, for instance, I mean, the health budget is very big. Within the health budget, you can move things from use A to use B to use C, right? To get the money to the places where it's desperately needed. Obviously, you're impacting other people, but that's how you work in an emergency. So at least one part of the mechanism has now been put in place. But what you really need is a budget. Now, let's move across the road, as well, up the road in the Jerusalem context, from the Treasury to the Bank of Israel. And we're now in the monetary sector, and this is a different ball game. So now we're talking about very different state of affairs, and let me explain why. You will surely be aware, you personally and many, I'm sure many of our listeners, there is a global dollar funding crisis. There is a global liquidity crisis, which has impacted all the markets in all the different ways we read. Israel is effectively immune, so to use the medical terminology, from this crisis, although we have seen the shekel doing some very remarkable movements compared to what we're used to. The shekel is regarded as an extremely stable currency because, okay, let me explain why. Because Israel has a balance of payment surplus. I call it a chronic balance of payment surplus. Now, balance of payment surplus means that our business transactions with the rest of the world, Israel Inc. versus the rest of the world, runs at a heavy profit.
And this just to put that in context, so the current account balance is about 5% of GDP, which is acceptable.
Well, last year, the latest data, which of course is what you're relying on, 2019 was exceptionally good and it was 5%, but it can be 2%, 3% in recent years. The point is that it is chronic. It is almost impossible to imagine a scenario in which Israel will not have a balance payment surplus. I will explain that in 1 minute. And this is extraordinary. Just in passing, this is the story of the Israeli economy in macroeconomic terms. Until the year 2002, for 54 years, Israel had a chronic deficit and had to live off borrowing from other countries, American support in times of crisis, and so on. The 21st century is a different world to the 20th century in terms of the Israeli economy, and the reason is because there is a balance payment surplus. And let me go further. The reason why there's a balance payment surplus at the end of the day is because of startup nation slash high tech slash startups slash all these things that you read and hear about. And to make a kind of a quantum jump forward, which would require an hour to explain, this is not going to change. Despite everything that's happened, this is not going to change. Now, in the short term, what that means is that Israel is we're very well padded. It has $140 billion of foreign exchange reserves, which, again, is small beer in American terms, but it's a third or more of GDP. It means that there is no dollar shortage in Israel. When a company gets into trouble because it has a funding problem, needs to meet some payments, a rollover debt, whatever, the money is there. And the Bank of Israel stepped in last week because the shekel was going shooting down, was collapsing, as it were, very rapidly. And the Bank of Israel said, we've had enough of this nonsense. We are going to start making money available. And they talked about $15 million just as a warming up, as it were. That immediately turned the market around. The shekel went straight back up. So Israel, now the other thing I need to say is that Israel at the national level, the government level, has incredibly low debt and virtually no foreign debt. The corporate sector has very low debt levels. So when you say Israel came into this crisis in very good shape, in financial terms, that's what you mean. The whole problem financially, as you all know, from Boeing to whomever, is liquidity. Can we meet our payments because our income has gone down, and so on? In Israel, these problems are much, much less than in most other countries. And in the specific context of having to meet dollar payments, there is no problem. That doesn't mean everything's hunky-dory, but it does give you a considerable amount of breathing space and of room to maneuver. So the Bank of Israel is sitting very pretty. Now let's go further.
I want to stay just on that last point you made about liquidity, both to stabilize financial markets and also to shore up the shekel on currency markets. With respect to the banking sector in particular, they've, you know, generally speaking, tier one, tier two capital, Israeli banks exceed 14% for their capital adequacy ratios. How resilient are they in this situation and the major banking groups? And what is the Bank of Israel doing to monitor and protect that situation?
Yeah, okay. So everything you say is correct. And the Israeli banks are in very good shape, again, relative to European banks, relative to American banks, and indeed in absolute terms. However, no modern banks, however well padded they are, can remain stable against an economy that has ceased to function, and we don't know for how long. Right? So the banks are facing the threat that they will, under existing rules and regulations, have to write off vast amounts of debt, which means that they'll go bust. That, in simple terms, is what we're talking about. The way to address that is to change the rules. That's what banking regulation does. CF 2008, many other cases, right? You say, no, you don't have to write off these debts as categorize them as non-performing loans after, say, 90 days or whatever it is. You can do, right? I'm making it very crude and very dirty. The banking regulators and the other regulators will change the rules to allow the banks to hold these loans and things on their books for some time. Now, again, everything is open-ended. We don't know how long. So this is not a game that you can play forever. But if this is a crisis of 3 to 6 months, then you're not going to have a situation in which the banks are obliged to write off potentially good firms, which the government eventually through the fiscal measures is going to pump support into to enable them to remain functional for the crisis period. You're right, you're going to change the rules to allow the banks to deal with things in a different manner, to be much more flexible. And so now this is possible and will work, again, because the banks are fundamentally sound.
Is it fair to say that's
another big advantage.
Is it fair to say that's sort of an interesting way of how valuation issues and liquidity issues are related? In other words, by not forcing assets to be written down, you know, or marked to market, given the current volatility, liquidity can be preserved by just sort of shifting the timing a bit and
you're talking about bigger companies that have marketable securities, whether it's loans or shares or whatever. The main problem facing banks everywhere in the world is, you know, the small and medium-sized enterprises, family businesses, local things, are the small guys who, as we know, employ the vast majority of people in the economy. And there's no capital market to fall back on. Right, so you need to do several things. First of all, you need to provide them liquidity, and the banks will say, well, we aren't going to take those risks, and the governments are, as we see in America and everywhere, coming in and saying, here is money, give it to the companies. And either implicitly or explicitly, governments are saying, if you don't give it to them, then we'll give it to them directly, we'll just bypass you, and that's happening with the Fed and so on. Now, we're nowhere near that stage in Israel for various reasons, but the Bank of Israel has, first of all, it's working through the regulations, telling the banks, you don't need the usual risk assessment thing. You don't, with small businesses, right? You don't need all the regulations, whether it's for the biggest businesses or for the medium size or for the local small self-employed people and so on. All the rules are being relaxed. Now, it is arguable, and I would certainly argue this, that this is where Israel has an advantage over most other countries. The speed of reaction of the governmental system and of the corporate, of the business sector, because this is a country which is well-tested in sudden crises, so albeit this is different to anything that's ever happened anywhere before, but there is a mindset thing, right? Okay, we've got to change things, we've got to adjust the rules, we've got to respond, and so on. This is happening. It's happening in the financial sector, it's happening with the regulators and elsewhere. And this is an enormous asset because both and rolling with the punch, and then when the time comes, please God, to recover, that will also be very important.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast, a product of the Miriam Institute. The Miriam Institute was established in order to provide a forum in which leading Israeli experts of diverse and disparate political and ideological perspectives could come together and share their experience, expertise, and opinions about the state of Israel for the consideration of our readership, listeners, and viewers overseas, by way of online content and in-person presentations, lectures, and events. You can learn more about these initiatives via our website, www.miriaminstitute.org. All of the work that we undertake is made possible by way of tax-deductible donations from people like you. We invite you to make a tax-deductible contribution to our organization via our website, and we thank you in advance of your support. Please enjoy the rest of this podcast, a product of the Miriam Institute. Israel's future in Israel's hands.
Let's look at consumers and consumer confidence. Household debt in Israel, what, about 40% or so of GDP, high savings rate, but nonetheless, resilience for a lot of households is going to be a huge factor, even with government assistance. I know, fortunately, in Israel, at least you have national health care that covers more than 90% of the population. But, you know, rent and food and just the impact of not being able to go outside or socialize in the ordinary way and loss of jobs. How are households dealing with this in the broader economy?
Okay, that's, again, that's a very difficult question. It's very broad and it's happening real time, right? So people are being constricted more and more. That means more and more businesses, shops and so on are closing down. It means more and more jobs are being lost. And the, come back to the consumer, it means I haven't got money. How am I going to go and spend? What am I, even my basic things, how am I going to do it, right? So it starts with mortgages. They've relaxed things. You can, the bank's been told 3 months, not to, 3 months of delinquency is not to be considered a problematic issue, and so on. And of course, behind that is the idea the government is going to actually pump money in. But as we've said, there is no government, there is no budget, and that's kind of being slightly delayed, but that will come. Let me put it this way. People are totally shell-shocked. People are under shock and awe, and they don't know what to do. And those of them who are making their calculations at home of eviscerated income versus reduced, somewhat reduced expenses are very concerned. And that's where the government has to step in. And that's what people are waiting for, in fact. But it's the behavioral thing is and all this is happening in the run-up to Pesach, to Passover, which is the biggest spending time of the year for consumers, and hence for the retail sector. Right, it's the equivalent of the period between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So it's it's kind of pretty disastrous, but the full impact has not yet been felt.
I appreciate the detailed answers to a lot of these questions. I want to turn now to some questions that we have from the audience, which have already come in online. One of the questions, which also ties to consumers, is from Joseph, who asked, what are the steps that consumers can take? And this probably is not just a uniquely Israeli question, but just globally. What steps can consumers take to encourage economic development and resilience, not just now, but in the aftermath of the coronavirus?
What steps can consumers take? And that's an incredible question.
Well, maybe I'll rephrase it anyway. It's, right now, obviously, if people are stuck at home or have lost a job or are just perplexed with panic, no one's spending money. Hoarding has been done. So as you move forward, there may be a continuing lingering effect, changes in consumer patterns and consumer behavior, which would, stifle the ability of an economy to recover. Conversely, there may be a sudden, explosion and just a shifting of time where if somebody couldn't buy something now, but hopefully, God willing, 3 months from now can, they suddenly go out and there's deferred consumption that occurs. I don't know which you think is more likely.
The key is, for consumers, the key is employment. From an economic point of view, it's quite straightforward. You have to have income or a sense of confidence that you have a future income stream in order to go out and spend anything other than basic stuff. Now, you mentioned, and this is again very critical, the level of consumer debt in Israel is incredibly low by any standards, right? Even the Germans are fairly profligate compared to Israelis. Although it's been growing rapidly in recent years, it came from such a low base. The amount of consumer debt and the weight of consumer debt is very, very low. And therefore, it is certainly possible to imagine a situation where recovery comes, and albeit the recovery will presumably be a gradual process, but people will be encouraged by the renewal of employment to go out and spend more. Whether we will see the number of Israelis going abroad for short or long trips that we saw in the last few years is an interesting question. And the whole tourist sector in both directions is very interesting. But looking at it realistically, if Israelis were not American, UK type consumers in the good years, then it's difficult to believe that they're going to go kind of run amok and buy everything in sight in the recovery period.
Right. Fear tends to be followed by kind of constraint as much as by relief sometimes. Daniel asks a question. How can Israel deal with unemployment and rising unemployed after this is all over? I guess it's another way of saying, what will be the new normal for the labor markets?
Yeah, well, of course, the correct and simple answer is we have no idea. Nobody has any idea. But the name of the game is, first, everybody's now focused on getting it under control. Now, let's be optimistic and assume, okay, Israel and the world get this under control, and and there is a gradual return to what we used to think of as normality. In other words, employment gradually comes back. Even then, we have to assume there will be significant changes in the kind of the structure of the economy and of employment. It will take time for domestic employment to come back. Obviously, tourism, that's kind of the first hit, the last to recover. But even local consumption and all the things that people do or used to do, such as going to restaurants and so on, that will come back gradually. There are other issues which are complex, right? The fact that the shekel is so strong has been a problem in the past. It's going to be a much bigger problem in the post-crash world, where the world has less buying power, and there's going to be a problem with productivity and whether the average Israeli non-high-tech company is competitive. Right, there's an issue of competitiveness which is going to be sharpened. So there are problems that you can identify down the road, but the key will be to restore the domestic economy, restore buying power, and gradually recover that way. But this is going to happen slowly. I cannot imagine any scenario. All this talk of economists sitting in rooms playing with spreadsheets of a V-shaped recovery and so on. This is just wishful thinking, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Even in a healthy economy.
That's right. In fact, some of the scenarios that I've seen even released as of this morning looks at the escalating risk of lockdown responses on major economies with the possibility of a global contraction of 1 to 2% as they're kind of low case and high cases, barely any growth at all, but still slightly positive depending on which market. All of those are significantly less than forecasted growth, in the pre-virus period. So I think you're right. There is a lot of uncertainty. There's also the question of whether, in a lack of effective measures in many economies to date, whether drastic reductions like we're seeing with lockdowns in Israel, in India, in many parts of the United States, in Europe, of course, in Spain and now France, the deeper those steps are, the deeper that sudden trough, hopefully the more prevention there will be, so you don't have even worse public health effects and even more prolonged recovery. But in any scenario, I think the recovery is going to be slow and uneven. There's a question that came in that also ties to the fact, I guess, kind of the aftermath of the public sector intervention to provide fiscal stimulus in particular. At the end of the day, that could create budget deficits for governments in Israel or around the world. How do you expect that to impact the public sector, either public sector employment, long-term debt, other things that will be needed to deal with that deficit spending? It's obviously necessary now. The question is how they'll deal with it later.
Yeah. Okay, this is a great question and a critical issue, and truth is I should have related to it earlier. But we covered it under this general heading that the Israeli economy is in very good shape coming into the crisis. One of the key achievements of the Israeli economy, for which Netanyahu can certainly take a lot of credit in his period of 10 years as prime minister, but the goes back beyond that. The Israeli economy has spent the last 15 years, and certainly the post-2008 crisis years, in getting its financial state improved. The state debt to GDP, which was 100% in 2003, has came down to 60 or just below 60. Now there's everybody else, the US, the UK, France, everybody except Germany and Switzerland was going up dramatically in 2008 and afterwards. Israel has been on the down escalator, and therefore the bottom line is, for our purposes, that the Israeli government can now say, we have spent 15 years getting our debt down. We are in an emergency. We are going to borrow massively, and we can well afford this. The United States, I don't want to go into what's going to happen in the government deficit and so on, but you're talking about $2 trillion package and all the rest of it. Countries around the world, most of the big developed economies, are playing with levels of debt which are extremely dangerous. Let's just leave it at that. The Israeli economy, like the German economy, has the luxury of saying, okay, we have been very frugal for a long time. We're now going to let loose. We've got to spend big. And therefore, the answer to your question, and this is very important if we take a medium to long-term view, when we come out of this crisis, we are going to spend an enormous amount of money, first of all, rebuilding the health service. There's going to be enormous investment in physical infrastructure and in many other areas, right, which hopefully will come at the expense of the army, but that's a different, entirely different story. Government expenditure is going to go up massively. There's going to be a lot of borrowing immediately and for some time to come, and we have the great advantage of being able to afford this.
We have a question about actually the health sector. Marlene is asking what Israel is going to do to address future pandemics. And obviously that's tied into also what Israel is doing with respect to treatments or vaccine development, not just for this, but for other potential viruses or flus in the future.
Well, I think the answer to the first part, what is Israel going to do vis-a-vis future pandemics, is that Israel and every country in Western Europe and North America and so on is going to look very closely at what Taiwan and Singapore and South Korea did after the SARS. And indeed, in America, I was told by a friend of mine today who has friends in the CIA and so on, in America, there are on the government shelves, in government computers, there are detailed plans of what should have been done 10 years ago and 15 years ago to prepare the country. In Israel, the guy in charge, I can't think of the name in English, right? The guy in charge of the government oversight office, right? The guy who criticizes all the other government ministries for what they're doing, published a report this week, which was actually completed 2 or 3 months ago, detailing how the health system is not geared up and not ready to face an epidemic, right? It's almost prophetic. But none of this is new, right? What should have been done is painfully clear. And after this is over, it will be done. And again, if you have the finances, then you can do a lot of things. But in Israel, it goes much beyond that. The number of doctors per population is extremely low. Ditto nurses. This has only begun to be addressed by opening new medical schools and so on. The whole of the health sector, which was creaking badly until February and is now facing incredible challenges, shall we say, is going to be totally revamped. And again, if you, the need is obvious. It is enormously advantageous if you have the resources available.
Yeah, I know, I'm talking not just in Israel, but in the United States and in Europe, people, especially in the United States, have talked about the chronic underinvestment in public health. I might add the chronic public investment in infrastructure generally, right?
Yeah.
But they take no joy in saying, I told you so. The question is, how do we then, you know, refocus budget priorities, you know, going forward and policies? I know we're seeing...
Yeah, and not waste money, not throw money away. I mean, as the tragedy of the American health system is that you spend twice as much as any other developed country and get less results.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I want to take, there's a number of questions at the end. I want to combine them into one, and this is really shifting gears a bit. But to conclude, a number of people are asking, personally, what should they do if they're, you know, fortunately in a position to have investments, whether it's retirement savings or whatever else. What should they do right now? So this is now moving into financial advice and moving away from the economy just for a moment. If a friend calls you on the phone and says, and you don't know much about their situation, what should I do in the market today? What would your advice be?
Okay, look, this, I'm very happy to answer this, but let's make it clear that this is basically a global question, very little to do with Israel, because we're not drilling down to that level of specificity. And it boils down to this. If you think that this is comparable to any of the recent crises, 2008, 2001, whatever, then you've taken a major blow already, and maybe you'll get through it and can react according to the normal slogans and mantra of the investment community. If you belong to what used to be a very small group of people, is now growing very, very rapidly, who believe that the American and the big economies were completely warped and distorted by endless government intervention and the pouring out of cheap money, and that the financial markets were ripe for a major blow throughout 2019, and that the troubles began in September 2019 with liquidity problems, which the Fed began to address and has pumped in more and more and more money. If you think that the whole system is now crumbling, then the only solution that makes any sense to me, at least, is to go to cash, which means in practical terms, you buy short-term government debt. In the United States, it's very simple. You buy treasury bills. You get no return. You waive any chance of upside because you think there isn't any, but you get the maximum degree of protection that you can. Now, there's a whole separate discussion of whether people should buy gold and precious metals. And there is a lot of logic behind having some, at least. But we are in a situation in which this bailout, look, let me give you one example. Boeing is a very large company. Everybody knows who it is and what it does. Right? It went from $300 to $90 in a very short space of time. In the last few days, last 2 days, it's gone from 90 to 170, 80, whatever it is now, because it was going to go bust, and now they're going to save it, hopefully. And this is just a simple symbol of what's going on. If you think that the governments are able to save everything and everybody by pumping out endless amounts of money, then you should be looking for what are termed opportunities. If you have doubts on that score and you have concerns about the stability of the whole system, then you have to adopt dramatic measures and do things that you thought you would never conceivably do, and basically it means going to cash. That is my opinion. It is an extreme opinion, but whereas it used to be off the wall, it is moving rapidly towards, I won't say center stage, but it is increasingly acceptable.
Pinchas, I want to thank you for that. I think we're going to leave it there, although I will say at least now we have slightly more certainty in these uncertain times. And your insights have really been hugely helpful. Can we check back in 3 to 6 months and see how it turned out?
Yes, hopefully we'll have good news then. I wish everybody well. First of all, health. They should stay well and should have as good a Pesach as you can.
Good. Thank you, Pinchas. Thank you to our audience as well. Stay healthy and stay connected.
And thank you so very much. Thank you, Pinchas Landau. And thank you, Alan Marks, board member of the Miriam Institute. And we greatly appreciate you bringing about such an insightful, important, and timely conversation. We look forward to reconvening in a couple of months per your suggestion, Alan. Thank you very much indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, before we conclude this call, we wanted to make you aware of what we've got coming up at the Miriam Institute for your participation and for your engagement. And before doing so, I just wanted to provide you with a very brief message. You know, we find ourselves at a time when numbers and figures really matter. On a daily basis, we're bombarded with numbers, whether those are the numbers of victims who have tragically fallen prey to the coronavirus, or the numbers as they pertain to the economy about which we've just heard. But Judaism as a faith actually takes a very clear but minority view when it comes to the issue of numbers, specifically the numbers of Jewish people. Now, you may or may not be aware of this, but tradition has it that Jewish people are not to be counted in the literal sense. In Orthodox synagogues, for example, when assessing whether or not a quorum is assembled before beginning communal prayers, members gathered are not counted numerically, but rather a passage that consists of 10 words is recited, with one word being assigned to each member present, at the end of which it becomes apparent whether or not the required 10 men are gathered. One of the reasons, according to Jewish teachings, that we are taught that as Jews we are not to be counted has to do with the diminutive size of our people in the context of the broader challenges that we face. In simple terms, if we were to look at the small size of our nation, ladies and gentlemen, when considering the scale of the challenges we consistently have placed before us, we would rapidly move toward a position of despair and defeatism, which would be a wholly unacceptable outcome. And so the Jewish faith and the Jewish people take a different path when it comes to counting. We are told not to count individuals, but rather to count the contribution that each individual can make as part of a collective. And the finest example that we have of this actually comes from last week's Torah portion, Pekudei, where we see examples of universal and particular contributions. In order to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the people of Israel were asked to contribute one half a shekel, as you know, which was a universal contribution. But there's also a particular appeal that is made, and the Torah portion prior to that actually uses the phrase and beseeches the people of Israel, saying, "Everyone whose heart motivates them shall bring linen, gold, ramskins, acacia wood, incense, oil, and more." And so, ladies and gentlemen, what we learn from this is that when seeking to meet a challenge, Judaism does not ask for Jews to be counted. Instead, it asks, as I mentioned earlier, that the Jewish people make a contribution, universal and particular, and that contribution is then counted, knowing that the sum and scale of that contribution will embolden the heart, the spirit, and the soul of the people of Israel entire, who are known, to use a pugilistic term, to punch well above their own weight regularly and often. And it's with that ethos in mind that we ask you today to consider making a contribution to the Miriam Institute, which you ought to view as an investment at this time. Our organization is a non-for-profit, for-purpose, 501c3 organization. And we are committed to providing you with briefings such as that which you just heard, and continuing with the core of our work during the course of this crisis and far beyond. And so as we ready ourselves now, today, to face the challenges that surely await when campuses reconvene, when legislators return to their offices, and when the media again turns its attention toward the delegitimization of the state and the people of Israel, we ask you in advance of that moment to make your contribution, whether it be financial or whether it be particular. If you wish to act as an editor for our writings and for our commentary, we need you and we invite your talents. If you wish to conduct an interview of an expert for the benefit of our listening audience, we want of your time. And we do, of course, ask you to view your investment, whether it be pecuniary or of any other kind, as precisely that, as an investment in Israel's future. With all of that having been said, you can do so by way of emailing us. Please email info@miriaminstitute.org to volunteer of your time and your talents. And also, you can make your donation by way of the invest or donate button at www.miriaminstitute.org. Tomorrow, we hope that you will join us as we have a briefing by Dr. Nachman Shai, former member of Israel's Knesset, who will be talking to us about how to disentangle ourselves in Israel from the current coalition crisis. It will make for a very interesting and timely briefing indeed. And please check the events page on our website regularly, as we will be providing and announcing upcoming telephonic and webinar briefings via our events tab. I want to thank our coordinator, Mr. Alan Langer, and of course, my colleague, Rosita Panini. I want to also express profound appreciation to Alan Marks and to Pinchas Landau, and to you, our listeners and our supporters. This concludes our briefing. Please stay well, please stay healthy, and remember, the only direction in which we can move is Kadima, onwards, together.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, a product of the Miriam Institute, Israel's future in Israel's hands. It's our pleasure to provide you with exclusive content about the State of Israel by way of lectures, seminars, debates, and position papers featuring Israelis who have been at the heart of policymaking and policy implementation. The Miriam Institute is a US-based 501c3 non-for-profit for-purpose organization. If you're enjoying this program, why not partner with us today? Join us in our mission to steer, inform, and lead the international discourse about the State of Israel. Whether you invest in our campus initiatives, our work in the halls of legislation, or our gold standard tours to the State of Israel for international students and faculty, you can invest in the Miriam Institute today by making a tax-deductible donation to our work. Visit us online to learn more about our legacy and naming opportunities at www.miriaminstitute.org. The Miriam Institute, Israel's future in Israel's hands.